G's at.
This up to you, Andy's screen room. The next person who signed in was John, KB2 Alpha Golf Bravo. KB2 Alpha Golf Papa. From Florida. I hope I haven't put you to sleep, John. Over to you for your dipole information. K2IW in the tech net.
K2IW, this is KB2AGP. Good evening. I was very interested in about that experiment with you guys at the FM. Just to follow up, we moved the dipole. We had originally had it facing north to south. We were trying to get into a net up in Jersey at 9 o'clock on 80 meters, 398.250. And we haven't been successful with it that way, so then we suggest I move the antenna to northwest, east-west diagonal. We did that. Still a little noisy. Let me drop it. So we had a little noise, so we had another 10 feet to the mast, and we got up a little higher. Still very noisy, and the band is terrible. But last night we started hearing stations from up in New Jersey, which was good. Let me drop it. So far, I haven't made a contact up to the guys up in, they're in Tom's River, along Tom's River, Forked River. They used to belong to J-Stars up there, and we were trying to play with them on 80 meters. But so the antenna is listening, but the band is terrible, and I haven't been able to make the contact back up to them yet, so we're still working on that. We're working on the Yaesu 450D and 80 meter dipole, or a dipole that's set up for 80 meters. Back to you, Dick. King Bravo 2, I forgot for far. I hope I covered it all.
I'm waiting for all the people. Very fine, John. So you moved your dipole from north-south to east-west. And I was recommending you just simply put up another dipole so you can flip back and forth between the two. They're not that expensive. But there's multiple ways of doing it. And the bands have not been in great shape lately. The sunspot cycle has been down to a very low number of sunspots. So the ionosphere is not giving you anywhere near as much support as it normally does. And on 80 meters, you can get an awful lot of D-layer absorption in the daytime, I believe. So I presume you're doing this experiment at nighttime. And all you need is an 80-meter three-element Yagi. There's a guy on QIZ.com where you can see a picture of a fully 180-foot-long three-element dipole rotatable on 80 meters. There's a guy in Japan who has that. And he opens up the band and closes the band, if you know what I mean. He owns the band and you borrow it from him. That would be a great way of doing it. Now, not out of the question, the next step of improvement you can do without great big investment, let me drop it, is to make a poor man's Yagi, a non-rotatable poor man's Yagi, two-element, three-element. If you set up a second dipole parallel to the first dipole, and the right distance between the two and the right way of feeding them, you can get at least 60 dB of additional antenna gain in the direction of New Jersey. So by investing a few more dollars by putting up another dipole, if you get the right number of supports nearby. And the second dipole can be a little bit higher, a little bit lower. It's not anywhere near as critical in that respect as you would think. So the second dipole, a little bit higher, a little bit lower, parallel to the first one, with the right spacing between the two, and the right way of feeding signals between the two, you can get at least 60 dB more gain. To get 60 more gain out of a dipole by raising its altitude, changing its length, out of the question. By setting up a second dipole as a poor man's Yagi, favoring that particular direction, you can easily get 6 and maybe even more dB of gain. Maybe you don't want to do it now, but as a later experiment to talk to these vital people in New Jersey, that's something worth considering, John, and maybe even doing it on both ends. With antennas, there's a zillion solutions. KP2, AGP, K2RIW. Back to you, John. Oh, by the way, I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey.
Okay, Dick, very good. That's something I might want to entertain. I only have one question. If I go with a second dipole, a little lower, not diagonal, same setup, am I feeding with one coax? In other words, I'd be putting in a T connector and feeding both Yagi, dipoles with the one feed line coming back down to the radio. and sort of like in that dimension, over?
There's a yes and a no to that question, John. It's going to require a little bit more research on your part. The second dipole can be a passive reflector if you make it the right lens, and you don't have to feed a signal to it. That's one approach. The second approach would be a T-connector feeding signal to both dipoles with the right phase angle, the right length of cable between the T-connector and the two dipoles to give the right difference in signal phase angle between the two dipoles to favor New Jersey. So there's two approaches at least, the active approach that I just mentioned and the passive approach, making it into a pure parasitic reflector by choosing the spacing and the length to be just right. And which one's going to work better? That's not easy to say. It'll take a little bit more research. So you've got at least two approaches on that one, John, and some experimenting between the two. You may decide to try it as a parasitic passive reflector, see how that works, and then later on feed signals to the second dipole and do it actively, see which works the better. I think the difference between the two approaches in dBs of gain is going to be small. I think you can get 6 dB of gain out of either approach. Let me take that back. The more I think about it, I think you're going to get a little bit more gain out of the active approach. But as you can tell, it can be done actively or passively, John. KB2AGP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Roger. I'll think about that and give it a whirl. I'll try with the T-connector to the one feed line, or either that, bring another coax back down into the house, and then I'll set up a T-connector at the radio itself. I'm on the right track, or am I off track at this point?
In theory, as a schematic diagram, bringing a second cable all the way down into the shack and a T-connector in the shack will work, but it's very vulnerable. When you've got a whole lot of feet of cable going to dipole number one and a whole lot of feet of cable going to dipole number two, coming down to the T-connector, you can easily end up with two different velocity factors of those coaxial cables because there were two different production runs, and therefore you end up with a mysterious phase shift, and you're feeding the second dipole at the wrong phase compared to the first dipole. So it's a lot less vulnerable if the T-connector is up in the air. And so there's a desirable difference in length of cable from the T-connector going to dipole number one and dipole number two. There's a particular phase angle that you want to feed dipole number two. I'm pretty sure it's a dancing phase angle. I think you're going to want a shorter piece of cable going to dipole number two from the T-connector compared to dipole number one. You're adjusting the phase angle as a function of the spacing between the two dipoles and the fact that you're trying to generate a signal that all the signal adds together toward New Jersey and doesn't add together toward Puerto Rico, if you know what I mean. So there's a desirable phase angle, and it's not super critical. It could easily be 15 degrees wrong in phase angle, and it'll still work. But when it comes to long pieces of cable coming into the shack, you can easily end up with 180 degrees of error, and you're now building a Yagi that goes down to Puerto Rico instead of up to New Jersey. Over to you, John, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KB2AGP. I'll put the T up at the top. Right now, the first dipole, or the only one right now, is up about 30 feet. You know, it's hanging on the hook, so to speak, with a tie. And then I'll put the other one up. Now, distance apart between the two dipoles. I got an 8 foot to my end of my property, to, in other words, the property line. So how far apart am I setting the other dipole versus the first dipole?
Yeah, that's going to require some more research. You're sort of asking the question, is there an exact spacing between the two that gives you the best performance? And the answer is almost no. As you change the spacing between the two dipoles, you have to change the phase angle that you feed them, the difference. You have to change the length of the cable to get the best performance. And as you get very close spacings between the two, the impedance of each dipole is going to change pretty fast, and that's going to require some extra fiddling. You'll end up with some standing wave ratio, which on 80 meters with good cable, that's not much of a problem. I didn't say say this is a simple solution. It is an inexpensive solution into the hardware required. The research required for the right spacing of the dipoles and the right difference in length of the cable from the T-connector to make it all peak up on New Jersey, that's going to require some research. I'm telling you now, it's doable. I just haven't given you the exact recipe to go and do it tomorrow morning, if you know what I mean, John. I'll give you some more thought about this during the week. KB2AGP, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. So, give me some thought. I'll do some thought on my end. I know next week you're going to be off, and then I'll check in on the following week and see what you come up with. And you have my call letters. So it's just KB2AGP, and it's just my handle's John, and I'm at AOL.com. So if you find something you want to send me an email on to work with as a guy, that can work. King Bravo 2 Alpha Golf Papa, John, Juliet Ocean Hotel, November, at AOL.com. I took enough of the next time, so I'll give it back to you, and we'll keep abreast. Maybe I will throw up on a duplicate dipole and see how it does. Back to you.
Very fine, John. And so the theory on this one is a little bit complicated, but doing it is easy when it comes to the amount of hardware required. Let's see if Ed wants to add some words. Oh, yeah. Doug, WA2SAY. Are you on frequency, Doug, WA2SAY? We got some information for you about Maxon Electronics is in Great River. Maybe that's the place you work for. WA2SAY, if you're there. K2LIW. And maybe Doug's not with us tonight. There will be no TechNet next week, but you guys know that we're unavailable. No TechNet next week. Okay, now we're going to go over to Roy, AC2GS. He's got some nice puzzles and other things for us tonight on his science talk. And he's still a little bit disappointed that you guys have not been sending him mailbag questions to be answered. AC2GS, Dr. Roy, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. How do I sound?
Right now, be beautiful tonight. Better than me.
Okay, I find that hard to believe, but thank you very much, Dick. Let me drop, and then we'll go on with the show. Okay, as always, want to remind people, just, I guess, academically, because very few people email me, but, you know, whatever. If you have any topics, if you have any questions, if you have any answers, if you have any refutations where you think I'm all wrong, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Everything that I talk about will hopefully have links posted to my webpage that you can click and read further about. And all you have to do is type into the web browser of your choice, roy.ac2gs.com, roy.ac2gs.com, and it will take you to my link page. And, of course, we have this lovely little chat room, me, Paul, and Lou, and everyone's welcome. And the easiest way to get there is to type into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com. So let me drop, and I will start with a fresh new puzzler. Last week, the answer was sand. This week, it's going to be way more esoteric, but hopefully just as enjoyable. Okay, last week, if you recall, Dick brought up a very interesting story about people using naturally occurring muon particles to better image the inside of the ancient Egyptian Great Pyramid. Cosmic rays, containing mostly the nuclei of hydrogen and helium, strike gas molecules in the upper atmosphere, and these collisions bring all kinds of interesting particles temporarily into being. Pions, kaons, neutrinos, gamma rays, and our massive little muon. Muons are rather curious particles. They're in the category called leptons. The uncharged leptons we know as electron neutrinos, muon neutrinos, and tau neutrinos. Not to mention their antiparticle variety as well. the charged variety of leptons are much beloved electrons, which we use all the time here in amateur radio, but this group also contains a much more massive brother particle called the muon, weighing in at approximately 207 times the mass of an electron. And in addition, there's an even more massive relative of the electron called the tau particle that's over 3,400 times the mass of an electron. Now, because of the muon's higher mass, it is not a stable particle, with a half-life of 1.5 microseconds and a mean lifespan of approximately 2.2 microseconds, after which it decays into an electron, an electron neutrino, and a muon neutrino, which might be a little bit confusing. Let me drop for a second, and I'll explain. You see, our atmosphere is something like 300 miles thick, but most of it is contained within only really the bottom 10 miles. The muons are created anywhere from 6 to 18 miles above ground level. But even traveling at the incredible speed of 99.9% the speed of light in a vacuum, it should only be able to get about a mile away from where it was created before it decays away. And yet these muons seem to get through that 6 to 18 miles of our atmosphere so that they can be detected by those muon detectors that experimenters that think they found a hidden chamber in the Great Pyramid. So my question for tonight, if you want to play along, is how the heck can a particle travel a mile but somehow get as far as 18 miles away?
I'm going to make a guess, Paul, is that the air molecules have a certain cross-sectional area. There is a certain probability of intercept. Therefore, there's a possibility that a very small percentage of these guys get through the 18 miles without hitting anything. Only a very small percentage of them. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Paul. K2LIW.
Well, Dick, you got to keep in mind that this is radioactive decay. Radioactive decay doesn't really worry about little things like banging into other things. A muon just by itself in about 1.5 microseconds will just spontaneously decay into an electron and two neutrinos. So the atmosphere is kind of a not really interacting in this at all.
Are you saying that the decay versus distance would happen in a vacuum?
Indeed. This is just a matter of time itself. If you take a muon and you just hold it in space for 1.5, well, if you have two muons in space and you hold them both for 1.5 microseconds, one of those muons will decay away.
Is there a possibility for a cosmic ray, for instance, to penetrate the atmosphere and create this muon a mile above the pyramid for that experiment? Is that scenario possible, Paul? I mean, Roy, get you out of it.
It's theoretically possible, but in practical terms, the overwhelming majority of muon creation happens at least the bare minimum, they say, of about 6 miles above. Anywhere from 6 miles to 18 miles. There's probably a few stragglers where the cosmic rays don't collide with any gas molecules until they get much, much closer, but that's not the solution to this quirky little puzzle.
N2JKB.
Yes, NJKB.
I'm going to not really answer it. I'm going to answer it with a question. Is there any kind of cascade effect where they might move a certain distance and collide with something else and cause a new one to be formed?
Okay, well, the short answer is no. Again, this would happen if it was a vacuum. You sort of need the gas molecules at the very beginning of this for the collision to occur, for the muon, for the energy of the cosmic ray to be converted into a muon particle. But at that point and beyond, the muons just slice through the air, and as we talked about, as far as the Great Pyramid, it flushes right through concrete to a degree and allows you to do imaging of enormous pyramids and such. So there's very little in the way of collision going on here.
Okay, well, I'm stumped.
It's an easy one. Like I said before, you know, last week was sand. You know, sand is sand. This is going to be a little esoteric, but I hope people will indulge me in this little lesson of something that I've mentioned a few times before. So it's not something brand new that I brought up, but it's a nice twist on an old theme. But is there anyone out there who would like to hazard any kind of a guess how a particle can have a lifespan, say, of 1 mile, but somehow stretch that into 10 miles of travel? Okay, I'll give you guys a hint. It's all relative.
I was just going to ask if it was relativistic, and one, why do you want it?
Very good, Hank. You want to expand upon that?
I assume that the speed at which it's traveling, time slows down for the particle, as the general relativity suggests that the closer to speed of light you go, the due to time dilation, the slower the time you will experience, or specifically a clock will experience relative to the initial reference point, or clock initial reference point.
Very good. Give that man a gold star. It's Einstein's special theory of relativity. It's all relative, so your frame of reference makes all the difference in the world. From the frame of reference of the people with the muon detectors, it's a consequence, as Hank mentioned, of time dilation effect. Something traveling at near relativistic speed, time as the muon is experiencing it, is only going at about one-tenth of the speed that we perceive time to be going. So it's not really violating its 1.5 microseconds half-life. It's just a matter of frame of reference. By the muon's perspective, by the way, it's not time dilation going on as far as it's concerned, if it has a concern. It might be traveling at 99.9% of the speed of light to Earth, but relatively speaking, it could just as easily see everything as the Earth is approaching it at 99.9% of the speed of light. And at those relativistic speeds, for it, space contracts. So there's a spatial contraction along the path of the velocity traveled, so that the Earth is now no longer a beautiful oblate spheroid that we all know and love, but it's flattened in almost this shape, like any good flat earther would love to see. Where we see 18 miles of distance between the upper atmosphere and the ground, the speeding muon only sees a mile or less. So the bottom line is it's all relative, and I've actually found a YouTube that demonstrates this pretty well. So I'll put that in the link page. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
One more thing, N1 Whitey White.
Yes, thanks.
Yeah, if you have time sometime during your part of this, I'd like to add a couple of things about the Boeing 73 MAX 8 that had come up since the last time. Talked about it on air.
Okay, sure. If there's no other further questions about this, we can jump to that as well. So does anyone want to discuss relativity or why particles seem to last longer and travel farther than they're supposed to?
If there's none, Hank, this MAX 8 problem, Boeing 737, it's getting more and more complicated as we dig into it, isn't it? It's not a pleasant story. Back to you, Hank.
Do you have any takers on relativity first?
Oh, well, I guess not, Hank. So we could move on to the MAX 8 and such. Feel free.
Okay. Well, as I'm sure everybody knows, the preliminary report came out, public radio, and therefore transportation fame, about 15 minutes of his 15 fame, according to Andrew, proceeded to tell the world that the crew of the Ethiopian 73 did what the manufacturer suggests. One drop.
Give us a little bit more audio, Hank.
Okay, is this any better?
Definitely better.
It all depends on how you hold the mic. Some I have to talk across and some I have to talk into. So anyway, the Ethiopian Minister of Transportation gets on, talks about how the flight crew did everything they were supposed to do, and space to crash and it's going to be a manufacturing fault. But when the transcript was released, that's not what was indicative in the actual words of the transcript. The transcript showed that while the first officer, who had all of 200 hours, which is nothing, the aircraft made the correct call and called for stat trim cutoff switches. Later in the flight, he was unable to manually trim the aircraft, and while it's not positive or not sure who did it, at some point there was electric trim impulse reapplied, which meant the switches went back to the on position. As soon as those switches were turned back on, the MCAS system erroneously started trimming back down. So clearly the crew didn't do what they were told to do. The manual, when I say told to do, what the QRH, quick reference handbook, tells flight crews to do, and it left those switches off. Another thing that was noted is that at no time did anybody retard the throttle. When the aircraft pitched level, and eventually pitched down, the amount of aerodynamic forces that were on the stabilizers while the aircraft accelerated were tremendous. And let me talk about why these forces increased. The aircraft, when it took off, had takeoff power set. The maximum amount of power that the aircraft would have used entire flight under normal circumstances. But when this mistrimming started to occur, when the MCAS system operated for its 9 seconds of pitch down with a 5 second interval between, pilots at no time retarded the throttle. So even though the aircraft had all the power it was going to ever make, it was no longer nose up. Therefore, when it went nose level to the ground, equivalent of leaving your foot on the throttle going down the LIE, accelerating as fast as it goes. And worse than that, when the aircraft ended up nose down, the aircraft indicated on the instrument that the pilots could read, 450 knots. Now, normally you climb out at 250 knots below 10,000 feet, accelerate to 320 above 10,000 feet. When you level the aircraft off, by the way, when you accelerate, you're climbing at reduced power, so you take off at full power. At some point after you retract the flaps, you lower the nose a little bit, power from takeoff power to climb power. That climb power setting for the rest of the flight until you level off, less of climb until you level off, and at that point you reduce the cruise power. I've never pulled the throttle back from takeoff. Ended up in level flight accelerating to over 350 knots, and then ended up with 450 knots indicated on the way down. Remember, these are indicated speeds, and if you correct them for position, temperature, and instrument error, go to calibrated speeds. These guys were doing 500 to 510 knots. That's just tremendously quick. When an aircraft accelerates through the air, the amount of force applied to any control surface is increased. In the case of the stabilizer, not able to manually trim the aircraft because they had this tremendous causes a binding pressure between the jack screw gimbal nut. Now, the jack screw is a thing that everybody talks about on TV. The gimbal nut is nothing more than threaded coupling in which the jack screw rotates. Threadle coupling has a couple of gimbals so that when between the motor and the stabilizer changes as it runs to its range, that it's normally the operating machine.
Bartlesville,
I'll get to you. Let me just finish my little spiel, if you don't mind, sir. So, anyway, these guys didn't retard the throttle. The thing was going fast as heck. They were unable to trim it nose up because of all the loads that were on it. If they had simply pulled the power levers back, the aircraft would not have accelerated. In fact, even when it was going fast, if they pulled it back, the load would have been able to manually trim it. Failure to trim the air or to control the aircraft speed, then we have a failure QRH correctly when they reapplied the electric trim. So we have failures there that were hidden, wording of the report, but not with what was given to our news media. Now let's talk about Boeing. to come out that only a single angle attack vane wired input is required to cause MCAS to operate. It's also come out MCAS only operates, autopilot is off, and the flaps are up, and there's no power input connected with this. So essentially, anytime when these guys did the right thing, tracking the flaps, doing takeoff, engaged the autopilot, and it kicked off. We don't know if it kicked off because it was in an out of trim condition after the angle of attack vane failed, or if it was data fault that caused it to trip off after the angle of attack vane failed. Either way, the autopilot trips off, the flaps are already up, these guys now have the MCAS running, and they don't recognize what's going on. They're going too fast. However, this is a fault because a single angle vane input was all that was required to initiate.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It would still operate, it would pitch up. It would still operate pitching them down after 5 seconds between shots, between inputs. This is very difficult for these guys to overcome. And of course, nobody's really been trained on what this was. That's another one of the issues. Let's talk about training. Why wasn't anybody trained? Nobody was trained. Boeing didn't include information from AFCOM. Information about it was made a corporate decision for aircraft to be flyable by a pilot who held a 737 type rating, a license to fly a 7, without additional training. Thought that this completely automated, simple system couldn't be discussed because they didn't want to say, okay, you need fighter hours to the airline, or simulator hours to train your pilots. Another thing that was happening is that FAA allowed Boeing to self-certify, and one of the reasons this was for a pilot who hadn't been trained is that this occurred only when the autopilot was on. The pilot disengaged the autopilot, had the mental assumption that he was gauging autoflight input, that this Boeing gas system would only operate when the autopilot was off, which went against the philosophy by which most trained, and that philosophy was Airbus, the automatic or the autoflight system, autopilot, flies the plane always, and the pilot makes suggestions. Boeing product, the pilot flies the aircraft, the autopilot does what he wants it to do, and if he doesn't like it, he can turn it off. Nobody bothered to tell the crews that they couldn't turn this particular part of automation off. So we've got a couple of failures stacking up in a row. The EOP crew, didn't do what they were supposed to have done, but Boeing didn't bother to tell the operators, hence the crews, that this is an aircraft. Boeing didn't do this at the selling point to operate these new aircraft. That, I think, I've pretty much expended what has come to light since the last. I heard Bravo Zulu in there, if there's anybody else after him.
Hi, this is Lucy 2 Bravo Zulu. I want to say thank you, you know, for taking us through this every week, because without your interpretation, it would be, well, the reverse of what's happening in Washington, put it that way. I have two questions. Number one, I don't know how to put this, but was the major incorrect input from the pilot turning back on the MCAP system?
Nope. He didn't know he was turning on the MCAS system. He was actually rearming it. What the fault was is that in both the Lion Air and the Ethiopian Airlines operation was that they re-engaged the electric trim system. When they re-engaged the electric trim system, there was a lot of pressure on the manual trim system. It would trim with the wheels that were in the cockpit. And they thought, okay, if we turn the electric back on, we'll be able to control it now that whatever has happened is over. Hold them. And I mean that the moment they turned this back on, they were rearming a system that trained existed.
You say rearming. In other words, it never did engage. It was just ready to engage. I'm talking about the NCAP system.
No, I'm saying it wrong if you're getting that question out. before MCAS can operate, flaps have to be up, the autopilot has to be off, and the electric trim system has to be in normal position. Then, if the angle of attack increases on one of the two vanes that are installed, then the MCAS will fire for 9 seconds, trimming the nose down, stop and wait 5 seconds to see if the angle of attack has changed, and then we'll refire, trimming the nose down again, trying to get that angle of attack to decrease. And it'll do this until it gets to the end of the authority of the jack screw and the stabilizer in the back. So they're not running switches that say, okay, turn on MCAS, but they're setting up the condition by which MCAS can operate after having had the angle of attack main failure. It does turn out, by the way, and I didn't mention this earlier, that the Lion Air failure was a faulty angle of attack vane, probably, but the Nopian air crash was a bird strike right on the angle of attack vane, and that clearly is a different issue than what happened in Lion Air. In Lion Air, the aircraft had this problem. Previous flight crew was able to deal with it and land, but they never wrote it up. They documented that, so it wasn't mentioned to the crew that was unable to deal with it and lost control and crashed. But that was a recurring problem with a bad physical part in the aircraft. The Ethiopian problem or crash occurred after a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Has the bird strike proved to beyond a reasonable doubt to your satisfaction?
Sorry, would you say the question again?
Was the bird strike proved beyond a reasonable doubt to your satisfaction?
Yes, there was evidence of animal detritus on the actual vane and on the wing root between the fuselage and on that side. So without actually seeing the photographs of the bird parts, bird detritus, I would have to say yes, it's beyond a doubt in my mind at this time. Now, of course, things can change when more information comes out, but it makes perfect sense. Now, let me drop it for a second. Started to say that the crew of the Lion Air flight, the White Nation, got on an aircraft where a vane was misbehaving and causing MCAS to operate on a previous flight. The previous flight crew members were able to correctly diagnose and deal with the problem, yet they did not correctly document this. We call it writing it up. And so when the new crew came on board, they did not know that there had been a problem on the previous flight, and these guys were unable to put the problem successfully. So you really have a previous crew that I believe was negligent communicating properly what had happened to the aircraft.
I feel this thing is going to go on and on and on, that we're just at the beginning of this investigation rather than the middle or end. That's just my feeling on this. So let me put my first question to you differently now. Was the major fault of the pilot turning back on the auto trim system?
Well, you're kind of getting there. It's not auto trim. It's rearming the normal electric trim. And yes, on both sides. Now, it turns out that if you get a stabilizer trim runaway in training, a lot of times people are taught to reduce power and to reduce airspeed to unload the, or reduce power and reduce trim, and to unload the vertical stabilizer. And by reducing the back pressure, by allowing the aircraft to descend at a reduced power setting, it will slow down and you'll be able to trim the aircraft again.
Okay, last question, and I thank you for answering all this. Made it much clearer in my mind, the whole thing, with tonight's explanation. I think you sort of answered this earlier, but let me ask it again. as a pilot, what do you believe was going through that pilot's mind when he turned back on the system? What did he think he was correcting?
My assumption is, based on the fact that nobody formed these pilots in this MCAS system with aircraft, when they tried to trim the aircraft manually, unable to do so because of the high loads, aerodynamic loads on the stabilizer, they then thought, okay, if we rearm vector trim system, we'll be able to use that jackscrew motor to our advantage, without knowing that there was an aircraft that was commanding the same jackscrew to turn in the opposite direction under certain circumstances.
All right, thank you, W2BZ.
Hank, if they had continued to use the trim wheel in the cockpit, which I think you said was getting difficult, could that have allowed them to return good trim? And is there any other way they could have seized command of the system as trying to do lethal things? Over to you, Hank, K2LIW.
Short answer is yes and yes.
But they needed training in order to know to do that, and that's what was missing. They didn't have information about the previous flight. They didn't have the training. To some degree, you can't blame them because they were in the dark.
Well, I do blame them that they turned the electric trim system back on, because the QRH, that aircraft, other airplanes I have flown that have had similar electric trim system with step trim cutouts and like that, tell you once you disengage the system, you never re-engage it. So, you know, it's hard for me to find a way to accept that they re-engaged it. However, the real thing is because Boeing never bothered to tell these aircraft, and every other Boeing that's ever been built, the pilots have been trained, turn the autopilot off, you have control of the aircraft. So it's unconscionable in my mind for Boeing to sneak the system in order to make the aircraft fly away relatively safe under normal circumstances.
Can you imagine a pilot living with MCAS where it does some terrible thing for 9 seconds, stops for a while, and then goes back and does it 9 seconds again, and the pilot's trying to figure out what in the world's going on? Why 9 seconds? Over to you, Hank. And Hank, we can use more audio.
WB2EAV.
WB2EAV, I think it was. I'll get back to you in 1 second. And Dick, your answer is, why 9 seconds? I'm sure that it's based on the speed at which the jackscrew moves and the desire, there's a dwell period that it operates in parts that it's off. So it operates for X number of seconds, they happen to be 9. And then it waits to see if that was enough to cause the angle of attack indication to be corrected. And if it's not corrected, then it reapplies for that same period of time and then stops to see if that would correct the fault. Continues to do this until it runs out of authority.
Wow. Ed, go ahead and make your comment.
The comment was, how could Boeing do this? And my answer is, Boeing allowed single point failure. There were two angled attack sensors, and they alternated them between flights. That violates every rule in the book. I mean, your car has redundancy and backup better than that. And if they can do that, they can do anything.
Well, Ed, that's really not unusual to have a system that's in control and then have a backup and it alternates between flights. What they should have done is had a third vane and a comparator so that in the event that all three vanes weren't saying the same thing, the two that were in agreement were the ones that were being providing input to the MCAS, or actually to the air data system, the MCAS. So the real thing is that they didn't have a third vane and a comparator. But there are many systems in airplanes where there are only two and they swap back and forth in flight. But most of those systems don't have deadly consequences in the event of a failure. And an example, just so you know what I'm talking about, and there are many. Most jet aircraft have two pressurization systems and literally swap the controller back and forth. Most jet aircraft have two automated transponders and swap them back and forth. But the failure of a pressurization system, the failure of a transponder, usually doesn't have a lethal consequence.
Agreed totally, but the point I'm saying is the way this is usually done in the avionics that I've worked on is you have a primary and a secondary. You work on the primary and you're using the secondary to check it. And if the checking, and maybe even if you can bring in a third one, indicates there's a problem, then you switch to the secondary. And you could alternate which is the primary, which is the secondary, all you want. Then you get into another thing. If it's a safety of flight, and there's non-safety of flight. And there's safety of flight, I think the rule is to try to get additional backup, and I would think, this is angle of attack, but I would think pitch from the gyroscopes would serve as a tiebreaker if you couldn't resolve it.
Well, that's still a separate system electronically, the gyroscope versus air data. But what Boeing did is, under the assumption that neither vane would fail, they wanted the first vane that tripped the system to have control of the MCAS, so that if a pilot was asleep, essentially, when he had the flaps up and the autopilot off, if he had overpitched the aircraft because he added power and the engines were slightly forward of the mean aerodynamic chord relative to the previous designs, and they allow the aircraft to rotate to a relatively high pitch attitude if you apply power rapidly, and the aircraft was in flight. And Boeing wanted this comparative system, or not comparative, Boeing wanted this safety system to fire under the first indication of a fault. And unfortunately, because there wasn't a backup, there's no way to turn it off, and Boeing didn't bother to tell anyone that it was there. We had these lethal consequences. If Boeing had put a third vane in and did this comparator, that would be your backup. A Rosemont vane, vanes are made by the Rosemont Corporation in Ohio, as are the P.2s, or essentially P.2s from these aircraft that are being called Rosemont Chrome. But it's essentially peanuts. These things are all, they're heated, they're made by one company. The company's been in business for 3 years. Problem, and unfortunately, Boeing designed this aircraft. Only one of the things required to be activated to cause the MCAS.
Yeah, I bet they said, what could possibly go wrong? Anything can fail. I refer you to the Air France crash of a few years ago with the pitot tubes. Had problems. So anything that's outside the plane is especially subject to problems. Could hit a bird or something. But the avionics systems I worked on, I worked on the E2D, and everything had interconnected data buses. So I suspect this system had a link where they had access to all kinds of data, and the computer at the core of this could have seen what the pitch angle of the plane is, as a backup, much like your car has a backup if your oxygen sensor fails.
Well, I agree with you on one and not on the other. I do believe that there are outputs available from all of these computers. Certainly they run through a comparator as an input into the system. But I will tell you that my car has a single oxygen sensor, and when it fails, I don't have a backup. Causes the red light to turn on, and the car goes from the closed to the open cycle and runs particularly rich. I know this because...
No, that is the backup. The car runs lousy. You have bad gas economy, but you get home.
Okay, I get you now. Getting back to Air France, one of the reasons Air France crashed, we all talk about the T-dot tubes. The T-dot tubes caused the auto throttle system to kick off. When the auto throttle kicked off, the pilot went off. And then all these other alarms started kicking off as the aircraft encountered more and more of a cascade failure. It's so difficult for the pilot to determine what the initial problem was because of all the alarms that were going off. Fundamentally, a case of the autopilot system, not Air France aircraft, flew the whole thing. And when it failed, it was very difficult for a pilot to figure out what was going on. And that's the philosophical difference between a Boeing and an Airbus. You would have thought after that that Airbus would have changed their system or their philosophy.
Yeah, but my point was the pitot tubes failed. Anything outside of an airplane is subject to the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune.
Yeah, Ed, but there's three of them on the aircraft, and all three didn't fail. The power to the heating system failed, and the aircraft was built in such a way that the failure of one wasn't detected, and it powered all three of them.
Again, failure to back it up, I guess, is what you're saying. And, oh, by the way, something else you added about redundancy. I'm sure you know every gasoline aircraft engine has two totally independent ignition systems.
Sure. And most jet aircraft have two, I'm sorry, most jet engines have two totally independent igniter systems for both start and override. And override, obviously, start, you know what that does. But override is if you fly through rain or ice precipitation, you want the igniter to go, even though it's not normally operated once the jet is started. But yet there's two 10-joule systems in most aircraft engines.
Agreed, agreed. Hey, Dick, should we secure from hijack mode and give it back to you?
As I zoom back from this most recent crash, I'm horrified by the fact that system failures on this Boeing 737 MAX can happen in such a way that the pilot cannot completely control that elevator and therefore control his angle of attack. If a pilot knew ahead of time that it's possible to get into that mode where he can't control the angle of attack, I, as a pilot, would be horrified. What would you, Hank, for any comment? We already know where we stand on this one, and my goodness, a great big comedy of failures created an awful lot of death. You've got it, Hank.
Well, Dick, I don't think that a failure like that with a U.S.-trained crew would result in the same accident. And I phrase it that way because if you do the QRH, you might be extremely disappointed with what you're left with as a pilot, but you'll be smart enough to, A, not turn the switch back on because you've been trained never to do that, and first step, trip, runaway. And B, you'll know to pull the power back because nobody operates with takeoff power when the nose is pointed down. It's just not a realm of flight that I've ever seen anybody do except in a simulator for fun. I've seen one guy do it on last ride he did when he was turning 30 days more to fly, and they still made him do his last check ride and screwed around for having fun with it. And he's the only guy, and he was doing it deliberately because he knew he wasn't going to ever do this again.
I wonder if it's possible that they left takeoff power on because they were so horrified and busy trying to correct this condition that was scaring the daylights out of them. When an airplane starts diving and you can't stop it from doing that, guarantee that takes priority over all the other check steps that you should be going through.
Yes. However, there's two pilots for a reason. One guy flies the plane, the other guy runs the checklist. And the guy flying the plane should have said, hey, this thing's going too fast. Let me pull the power back. He has to stay in the loop as the pilot flying. And the non-flying pilot operates the checklist and the radios. Sometimes the captain will actually let the co-pilot fly the airplane. He'll run the checklist if it's particularly complex because he understands where things are going. But most of the time, when things go bad, the pilot or the captain flies the plane and the co-pilot runs the checklist.
200 hours, co-pilot.
A previous flight had a similar condition that they managed to survive, and they didn't properly report it. Guarantee they feel a little bit guilty right now, Hank.
First, Ed, yeah, 200 hours, and he was the one who made the correct call to call for staff cutoff trim. It wasn't the captain, it was the co-pilot. And so he was not, you know, he was the one who was, in my mind, more involved and more understanding of what was going on than the captain did. One. Number two, going back to Dick, that Lion Air crew, failure to document that, I mentioned this in an email to Roy, I think it's a function of the mission accomplished mentality that a lot of people in aviation have. Unfortunately, if you don't have the training and operational experience to back that up, if you get caught up in the, hey, we can do anything mentality, that's why they didn't write it up, because they said, oh, if we write it up around the airplane and, you know, that'll cost the company money, thinking that it was an intermittent problem that wouldn't come back, not realizing what the nature of the actual failure was.
I should report to you, Hank, that on each one of your transmissions, when you start transmitting, you sound beautiful. Near the end of your transmission, you start sounding pretty noisy. We don't have enough audio. I believe you're having some form of overheat condition on a particular transmitter you're using at this time, Hank. Go ahead.
But, Dick, it might be my power supply.
Understand. Valuable information. Awful glad you're keeping track of this one, Hank. There's an awful lot of lessons to be learned here. And, I'm about to take a flight, and I made sure that I chose airlines that do not, in my particular flight, use a 737. Any further comments you want to make, Hank, before we go back to Roy? N1YDY, KJIW.
Wait a minute, Dick. That's an overreaction. There's nothing wrong with the earlier 737.
You're probably right, but I'm overreacting. Go ahead, Hank.
Certainly, the 737 is the most looked at, most inspected, and at the moment, most in the training loop aircraft, in the mix of aircraft in any airline fleet, because everybody who's flying a 73 back in the books looking for what else they've forgotten since the last time they sat in a ground school.
Good information, and thank you. Roy, I think we ought to go back to you, and, Hank, good information. Thank you. AC2GS, KJIW, sorry for such a big interruption, but I think it's needed.
No, Dick, it was fine. It was informative, and I thank Hank a great deal for adding his expertise to this segment. I appreciate people know what they're talking about those things. So it's all good. Anyway, on to the next subject. A few months ago, we were talking about eclipses of all kinds, and someone actually asked about solar eclipses as seen from other planets. Well, I have a very nice link that I'm going to put up on roy.ac2gs about solar eclipses on Mars looking like. Mars has two small moons. There's Phobos. It's the larger one. It's 17 miles across. While Deimos is just 9 miles in diameter. Now, using MASSCAM, Curiosity recently captured the moon's passing in front of the sun. The NASA rover has done this before, but these new eclipse images released by NASA this past week are among the best that I've seen. The Phobos eclipse was captured on March 26, 2019. The event is considered an annular eclipse because the moon doesn't completely obscure the disk of the sun. Deimos eclipse happened on March 17th, 2019, and technically speaking, it's not really an eclipse owing to the small size of the moon and how little the sun is actually being covered. This is more of a transit, similar to how distant exoplanets move across their host stars and are subsequently spotted from our vantage point on Earth. Mark Lemon of Texas A&M University, a co-investigator with the Curiosity MASSCAM project, said the observations these are improving their understanding of where these moons are located relative to Mars. 15 years ago, before the Spirit and Opportunity missions, the presumed location of Deimos was off by 25 miles, according to a NASA press release. Let me drop for a sec. quote, more observations over time help pin down the details of each orbit, end quote, says Lyman. Lemon in the NASA release. Those orbits change all the time in response to gravitational pull of Mars, Jupiter, or even each Martian moon pulling on the other one. Phobos orbits Mars pretty close in. It's just 3,600 miles above the surface of Mars compared to 230.